come back.
Yes, of course, one of the all-time TV theme songs. 1975 to 1979, that song was heard at the beginning of the show that starred my next guest. The show, of course, was Welcome Back, Cotter. And we welcome back Gabe Kaplan, who's in town to do some stand-up at the Comedy Forum in St. Peter's this weekend. Hello, Gabe.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
All right, Paul.
Now, let me start with a question from one of your areas of expertise, and I know there are many. All right, here's the first question for you.
You asked me about snacks at the movie theater.
No. We can talk about that if you want, but I got to get this out of the way here.
Okay.
You're in a low-limit hold'em poker game with a pair of tens under the gun before the flop. Do you bet, raise, or fold?
It depends who you're playing with. It depends if it's a limit game or a no-limit game. It depends if you feel lucky.
All right. I had to ask a poker question because Gabe is a poker champion, right?
Well, I won a couple of tournaments, and it gets a lot of publicity when I win, and it doesn't get any publicity when I lose. So
But you won the Super Bowl of poker, whatever that is, a couple of times, and I know you played in the World Series of poker out in Vegas several times.
Right, uh-huh.
Is there a chance you'll be showing up at the St. Charles Casino or the Admiral downtown, sitting down and playing against the locals this weekend?
Yeah, I'm looking for a good poker game in St. Louis. High stakes, 5 and 10 cents, something like that.
But you've developed kind of a reputation, so people see you coming now, don't they?
Yeah, in fact, it's kind of the thing where I just play in tournaments because it's like I can't play with friends because if I win, they feel bad, and if I lose, I feel bad. So it's a no-win situation.
When did you start developing poker skills? Was it while you were making the TV show, or on the road doing stand-up, or how did that happen?
Actually, as a kid, and I'm really only good at no-limit poker. Limit poker is a different thing. It's like, someone has the most patience and could count the cards and see exactly what hands are out. And in no-limit hold'em, it's really just a judgment of personalities. You know, is somebody bluffing or isn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a one poker game that I'm really good at. And that's the game that they play in all the tournaments. So a few times I got lucky and I got a lot of publicity. But like I said, I've lost a lot more than I've won, and that never gets. You never see Gabe Kaplan got knocked out of a poker tournament, the fourth person to go out. But if I do come in fourth or third, or if I win, then it gets a lot of publicity.
Sure, but you started playing as a kid?
Yeah, I started playing as a kid in New York, and then I noticed that the kids that had the most control and could, not really. What they call in poker steam, after you lose a hand, you get mad and you want to play immediately and you want to try and get your money back. And I noticed that those kids were really good, but if it came down to a big bet where someone was making a big bet and it was a judgment on whether or not the guy was bluffing, then I was pretty good at that. I could generally pick up signs at what someone was doing at the important points, and that's what No Limit's all about.
Yeah, I play a little bit of poker myself at the card rooms around here, and occasionally, once a year, I go out to Vegas,
I heard about your game. I said, oh boy, Paul's here again. Yeah,
yeah. And then they say, we're getting another car this year. He's here again.
Honey, clean out the garage.
No, but what I was going to say is I go sometimes to the Bellagio, which is kind of the poker mecca now out there.
Yeah, it is.
And all these big-time poker pros sit around, and they're playing with sums of money in front of them that the average guy, makes in a year. That's what they're sitting down at the table with. Have you played against these, Johnny Chans and these kind of guys?
Yeah, in the tournaments I played against them all. And I actually did the color broadcast of the tournaments. I was the color man for a couple of years, and I got to talk to all of them and interview them. So it was fascinating for me, having a real affinity for it.
Most of these guys just sit around waiting for some rich sucker to come along and say, I want to play against the best guys in the world.
Right. And there's not too many of those guys as you would think. Once in a while they do come along, but it doesn't happen that often. Like if you look in the World Series of Poker, if there's 400 players, 380 of them are professional poker players from all over the world, and 20 are just people that are taking a fling.
Yeah. It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Gabe Kaplan. Let's talk about Cotter for a couple of minutes here. Nowadays, any stand-up who does, three or four gigs at the Funny Bone or Comedy Forum the Improv somewhere, after about their fifth gig, they're offered a sitcom. It wasn't that way in the mid-70s. How did you get Welcome Back, Cotter?
Well, I think I was the first one who... They based a sitcom on my act and the kind of material I did, and then that became the vogue where in the 80s and 90s. They did that a lot. They look for a young comedian who they think is funny and has potential, and then they model a show on his humor. Mine was really modeled directly on my act because I had talked about the guys I went to school with and what kind of school it was in New York and how it was a remedial class. And then I had done this on The Tonight Show. People forget that I was a stand-up before Cotter. You know, I was doing stand-up on television for like 10 years before Welcome Back, Cotter. And we just said, well, how can I... These guys are funny, and being associated with them is funny, but now I'm 30 years old, and how can I still... And we actually thought about a show of doing a show where a group of 28, 30-year-old guys who just never grew up. You know, everybody else moved on, got married, went off, joined the Army, did whatever they're doing, and these guys are still functioning the way they're functioning when they were 16. You know, there's always that three or four guys that still live at home that never grow up. Mm-hmm. And I said, how about a show about those guys? And we'd have Horshack and Epstein and Washington and Barbarino, and I'd just be one of them, and it'd be the five guys who never grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to do that, but then we just said, well, how about we switch it around and we make me the teacher? So instead of being my contemporaries, they become my students. And that seemed to fit a lot better. So that's how it happened.
But how did who came to you, you know, or maybe they saw you on the Carson show or in some club, you know, wherever it was. Did somebody walk up to you and say, I'm going to give you a show?
Well, you know, this is, we're talking, you know, 1974, 1975. I mean, this should be on the History Channel now. But what happened at that time was I was like the hottest comedian on television.
Sure.
And when that happens, when you're doing all those talk shows, and I even did a stand-up on the Emmy Awards. I actually got out on the Emmy Awards one year and did 7-8 minutes of stand-up. So I was... they were looking for a show or looking for something for me to do, and it was sort of a competition between the networks at that time to come up with the right concept for me to do. And when I said, well, I want to do it myself, it was kind of unique at that point because, you know, most comedians had gotten shows where someone else wrote a show for them.
Right.
But this was unique where I created my own show.
Yeah. And did you get to continue creating it? Did you write a lot of the scripts those first couple of years?
I did in the first 3 years, and I was really involved completely with the show. And in the fourth year, I was really part of, I was honored to be part of a E! True Hollywood Story, you know.
Honored, huh?
Yeah, right. You know, they came to me originally, and they said, everybody else is doing it, and we really want to hear about what happened on Welcome Back, Cotter. And I figured, well, I might as well give my perspective on what happened. And I talked about, basically, at the end of 3 years, I thought that the guys were too old to be in high school. You know, they were starting to be 26, 27 years old.
And looking it.
And looking it. And I said, you know, this is getting ridiculous already. How about if Cotter gets a job at a junior college and he walks in his first day and who's in the classroom, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So how does that sound? And they said, no, you know, they're in this school and we're going to go another year. And I said, it's just doesn't make any sense. They just look too old.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a, you know, little conflict in the last year of the show where we had different ideas on where the show should be going.
And in that last year, you appeared very rarely, and John Travolta appeared very rarely.
Right.
And so the rest of the people had to carry it, and the show was, you know, basically you, and, well, Travolta had, you know, had that breakout role, and once you guys weren't around anymore, that was pretty much the end of the show.
Yeah, well, mine was a creative difference. His was because he was maybe the biggest star in the world at the time, and he just couldn't, and he worked out a deal with them that he did like 6 shows in the last year, and they accepted that, which was very nice of them at the time, and they said, okay, John, you do 6 shows for us, and we won't have any arguments, and that, you know, that's how that happened. Mine was a creative difference, and his was because he had plenty of stuff to do.
Yeah, Saturday Night Fever, and then on to Grease and other things. Now, when you have a hit show like this, and although it was never a number one show, you were consistently a top 10 or 15 show on ABC.
Right.
When that comes to an end, even if it's over creative differences in the last year, do you then have people come in to you and say, all right, Gabe, now let's do a new one? You know, I mean, Bob Newhart gets show after show after show. Did that ever happen to you?
Yeah, I did another show, which lasted for one season. Nobody remembers it. And that was like 2 years after Cotter. And after that, it sort of I fell into that area where you could still work as a detainer, and you do whatever comes your way. You're not at the same level that you were functioning at when you were really hot and a big television star, but you can get like the second or third part on a show. You can still do plays. You can still be a guest on television shows. But just at that time, like 1983, I just decided not to do that and to try my hand at other things and completely drop out of the business and see what I could do in other areas. Because I had been a comedian since I was like 17,
mm-hmm.
and I've been working steadily since that time. And since I wasn't really at the top of my game at that point, I could have, you know, tried to get back up there, which is what most entertainers do, because acting, performing is their life. That's what they enjoy doing. And even if they're not doing it on the same level that they were once doing it on, they just have to. They have to act. It's what gets them off. It's
right.
What really makes their life worthwhile. But for me, it was, I was just tired of it, and I said, well, since I'm not hot anymore, let me try some other things.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, talking with Gabe Kaplan, who's at the Comedy Forum in St. Peter's for two shows Friday night, two shows Saturday night. You can get tickets at 636-498-1234. Let me just ask you a couple of things that I've heard about the Welcome Back, Cotter, and then we'll move on to other stuff here.
Yeah.
When that show first started out, teachers were not happy with you, were they?
No, that's not true. There was a few. There was a few sporadic instances, like, for the first 6 weeks of the show, it was banned in Boston because some person who ran the affiliate, the Boston ABC affiliate, had seen the show and said, oh, this is too controversial, and this is about juvenile delinquents being funny, and, you know, and totally ignored the relationship with the teacher and how the teacher was trying to better these kids and devoting his whole life to seeing that, you know, ignored all the interpersonal relationships and just saw that they weren't the best students and said, well, you can't have a show about these kind of students. So they didn't show the show. We were actually banned in Boston for 6 weeks.
That is ridiculous.
No, you know, it is ridiculous.
Now, when they came into a meeting and told you we're not going to be on in Boston, you said, why? And they told you that. Did you go, get out of here? Well, I mean, how do you take that kind of news?
Well, it's the same way where you take it, where we've been saying up your nose with a rubber hose for like the first 5 weeks of the show, and then someone comes in and says, from the network, says, you can't say that anymore. And I say, why? And they say, well, rubber hose is too violent to say up your nose with a rubber hose. So I said, what are we going to say? And they say, well, say up your nose with a garden hose. So I said, well, isn't a garden hose made of rubber? And they said, yeah, but it doesn't have the same image. So for one show, we had to say, up your nose with a garden hose. And then the next show, they realized how stupid that was, so we went back to it. But there actually is one Cotter show where we had to say, up your nose with a garden hose.
That is unbelievable.
I mean, what goes on in network television is just like, you know, the inefficiency that you can find in any business. They just go with what's successful. You know, if you see a successful show, like The Millionaire comes on, and then they have five or six other shows just like it that don't make it.
Yep.
But the people feel that they have validity if they say, well, since that's successful, I'm going to recommend to quit. Nobody wants to step out and get up to the plate and do something different, original, because you're in jeopardy. If it doesn't work, you have more jeopardy, and if it works, the positive things that come from it. So people tend not to take chances and try to play it real safe.
Well, the show was on for 4 years, and those first 3 years you were very involved in it and very proud of it, I'm sure. Did it ever make the overseas markets? Did you ever see yourself being dubbed into other languages?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I mean, in all languages, I could get on planes in Asia and have people come up to me, you know, go, oh, Mr. Cotter, Mr. Cotter, oh, Mr. Cotter, you know, and I think I spoke the language because they had seen me speaking the language on television.
Right. Did they even have the people who did your voice? Did they even try to approximate your accent, or Horshack, or anybody?
No, you mean like a Japanese Brooklyn accent?
Yeah, you know, something like that. I mean, we have actors in the movies who try to be other nationalities, but they don't do that when they're dubbing TV shows.
No, it was just a straight. When I saw a straight Italian, straight Spanish, and straight I didn't hear any 33rd and thirds there. You must have 33rd and thirds.
And when you were originally putting the show together, did you get to cast Travolta and, you know, the other sweat hogs?
Yeah, that was the whole thing. I was really involved in the show. We cast, we actually cast Travolta and Lawrence Hilton Jacobs in Los Angeles, and we weren't happy with the Horshacks and the Epsteins that were showing up, and we took it then to New York, and we got Ron Palillo, who we knew was Horshack as soon as he walked in the room, and Bobby Hedges played Epstein. We knew that they were right, you know, when we got to New York, but, you know, and I said, hey, we just don't have the right people in Los Angeles. We don't have all four of them.
Had Travolta done anything before you guys found him?
He had done, he had a part in Grease in the Broadway show, a minor part. And he had done a few commercials and a few minor roles, but he hadn't done anything really big.
Yeah. And what about this trend of turning TV shows into movies? Do you own the rights to Welcome Back, Kotter, and can you make a movie out of it if you want to?
Yeah, we own the rights to it. The writers own the rights to the movie versions of television shows, not a TV remake or reunion. We don't own that. But if there was a movie version, Alan Sachs, who co-created the show with me, we own the rights, so we can do it. So if you know anybody that wants to do a movie, let me know.
Have you walked up to anybody in Hollywood and said, hey, you know what, how about a 90s or 2000s version, or even an 80, you know, updated a little bit, like, you know, maybe something campy like they did with the Brady Bunch, or are you not interested in going there?
No, we're interested. We've been trying to, you know, since we own the rights, we've been trying to see who's interested, and people... What happens is the same thing as always. Now people are interested again. We're talking to people because of the success of Charlie's Angels. But a television remake comes out that bombs, like McHale's Navy, and all of a sudden nobody wants to do them.
Yeah, I know Car 54, Where Are You? Probably killed a lot of projects a few years ago.
Right, you know, Leave It to Beaver. You know, a lot of them are not successful. Then
right.
You get a Charlie's Angel that's successful, and everybody's looking for properties until the next one comes along that's not successful, and then you can't. So right now we're, you know, that's alive again. We're talking to people about possibly doing it, and I think the best way to do it is to keep it, you know, current, keep it like 2001, and have someone, you know, a young hot comic play Mr. Kotter. You know, I think someone like Chris Rock would be perfect to do something like that, and then I could have a, you know, like Kevin McCarthy in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You know, I could be a little more, maybe I could play Mr. Woodman.
Yeah, you'd be Woodman.
Yeah, that would be funny.
Let's talk now about another project of yours, which I really enjoyed, was when you did the one-man show as Groucho Marx.
Right.
I was a big Marx Brothers fan. You obviously were, because of the passion that you could see in the performance. I didn't see it on stage, but I saw it on HBO. Did you get to know Groucho?
Yeah, I got to know him pretty well. I had met him a few times. He had actually come to the set of Kotter and watched us tape a couple of shows. In fact, he was almost on one. He would have dinner with us. You know, you do two shows when you do a sitcom. You do a first one, and then you have dinner, and you talk about it, and you make a few changes. Then you do a second one, and they combine the shots from the first one and the second one. Usually, generally, use most of the second one, and that becomes a show. I don't know if they still do it the same way today. From what I've heard, they don't. But that's the way we used to do it. And he had come to the show, and we were having dinner. And I said, Groucho, you know, as long as you're here, how about if at the end of the show I'm sitting on the bench outside the school by the bus stop, and your back is to the camera, and you're sitting on the bench with me. And I say, sir, as long as we're waiting for the bus together, let me tell you about my uncle. And then I tell you an uncle joke, and you turn around, and the audience sees this Groucho Marx, and they go crazy, and then you say, well, that was the worst joke I ever heard in my life. So he said, all right, well, what joke are you going to tell me? And I told him the joke we were going to do that week, and he said, well, that is the worst joke I ever heard.
And how come he didn't do it? He never appeared on the show.
He didn't do it he never appeared on the show because... the woman who was his guardian asked for some ridiculous amount, like $25,000, for him to do that. And the producers, of course, you know, wouldn't pay that. And as much as we wanted him, and I tried to see if I could mediate it and get, she was like insistent that he had to be paid some enormous amount of money for doing it. And he was just really looking forward to doing it, you know, and you could see him. He was excited about being able to do it, and then it just didn't happen.
Oh, that's a shame. But getting to know him, I mean, I got to tell you how jealous I am. am of the fact that you got to actually sit down and even have dinner once with Groucho Marx. what is that like? Was he Groucho all the time?
He was Groucho in spurts. Like I went to see him. This is not when he died, but this is like about 4 months before he died. He was in the hospital, and I went to see him, and he said, "Well, what are you doing with yourself? You know, you're still doing the show?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, we're still doing the show." I said, "You know, I want to open a comedy club." He said, "Well, what are you going to call it? You can't call it Kaplan's. They'll think it's a delicatessen." And I said, "What would you call it? If you had a comedy club, Groucho, what would you call it?" And he looked at me because he couldn't think of something. He was trying to come up with a Grouchoism, but he couldn't think of one.
Mm-hmm.
So I went home, and as soon as I walked in the door, the phone was ringing. And I pick up the phone, and he just said, "Club Foot."
See, that's great.
Yeah, I know. It took him about an hour, but it
it paid off.
Yeah,
it paid off.
Right, but that's what he would have said, you know, like 40 years earlier.
And when you were on stage, did you feel like, you know, not only am I acting as Groucho, but I'm kind of channeling him here for the audience because I got to know him?
Well, I felt that when I did it. The show is Groucho at three stages of his life. One, when he was doing the movies with his brother. One, when he was doing the television show. And then him as a really old man, the guy with the beret that we saw on the Dick Cavett show.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did that guy, that was the guy I knew. I never knew Groucho, you know, the final stages of his life. I think the first time I met him, he was like 84 years old, 83, 84 years old. So he was in the final stages of his life. So that was the guy I knew, and that was the guy, you know, that I had lunch with, and that was the guy that came to see Welcome Back, Kotter. So I felt a real affinity for that part and for that guy.
And that's the one that came through you best on stage.
Yeah, yeah, I think definitely.
It was terrific work.
Thank you.
One other topic I got to touch with you, when you stopped doing showbiz for a while there in the 80s, and before you turned your brain to winning money at the poker table, or as you say, losing it, you actually turned into like Mr. Stock Market for a while, or at least financial stuff, right?
Yeah, I became an investor and invested in all the financial markets and did okay, you know, had a lot of winners, a lot of losers, but really got involved in bringing some companies public and you know, raising the money to bring companies that I thought had a future public. Nothing really big, but some, you know, small restaurant chains, medical device projects, different things that couldn't go the standard way because they were too risky. So how to raise money through a private placement. And, you know, I had some winners and some losers, but I really enjoyed that, just watching a company grow and getting involved in the financial backing from the beginning of the inception of trying to take a company public. So it was something that, you know, just like I enjoyed being in show business, I enjoyed that. And I'm really doing less and less of that. And I guess I'm lucky that I got out at the right time.
Good timing, Gabe.
Yeah, it was really, really good timing. But I always hedged in certain areas as far as just generally buying stocks on a speculative basis. I think you have to hedge and just be careful of what can happen in any market is volatile. You know, we had a really great run there for a long time, which I didn't expect it to go on as long as it did.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I felt, you know, now that I'm in my mid-50s, I just feel excited about coming back and trying to do comedy that appeals to, I think, people that have the similar life experience that I have, that I have, because I don't see a lot of comedians talking to those people about things that they can relate to. I see comedians who are either really young or really old doing nostalgia material or talking about what's going on today, but not interpreted through the eyes of someone who's 40 and over as far as what's going on in the world and how it's changed and how we relate to the new things that are happening and how the younger and the older generation relate to each other. There's always a generation gap in every time period, and you know, it's sometimes it gets stronger than others, and I don't really think it's that big now, but it's there. So you know, just talking about things like that are interesting. And I watch Jerry Seinfeld on Letterman last night. Did you see him?
Yeah, I did.
It's like he still has that need, you know, I don't think it's ever left him, of being a stand. Here's a guy that's probably made more money than anybody in the history of television. And he just has that need, which is unique, because most guys who become real successful want to stop doing stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
They want to go and do movies.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't seem to have any of those desires. He just likes to get up and do stand-up.
And that desire is back in you now.
Yeah, and that came back in me. And I find it interesting that it never left him. he just doesn't want to do anything else. We're different people in that regard. It's like we're both doing stand-up now. And I thought it was, didn't you think it was kind of unusual for a guy that's this successful to want to go back immediately and get on stage on the David Letterman show and do a stand-up?
I did think so. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't think it was that good last night either.
Uh-huh.
I thought he was okay, but after he sat down with Letterman, he didn't have anything to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you would do Carson and you'd get over there and sit down in the chair, you knew you had to do panel and you had to have stuff prepared. Now, you know, Seinfeld sat down last night and didn't seem to have anything prepared.
Well, I think what happened to him is David Letterman is different than Johnny Carson was, and even different than Jay Leno is, because he doesn't like everything to seem prepared.
Mm-hmm.
He likes to take you a different way.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works out great. Sometimes he can not ask you a direct question like he's supposed to ask you, go into another area, and then you got to segue back into what you really wanted to do.
Yeah.
And it can be real funny, and it can be more spontaneous. And I think with Jerry last night, I think it was good. You know, it was funny. The stuff he did was funny, but you know, it probably could have been better.
Mm-hmm.
If both of them had felt, I think there was a little tension there. You know, it's like, you know, he's got this guy who's the biggest stand-up star ever, went out on top. That doesn't usually happen.
Right.
And I felt you know, it wasn't as smooth as it possibly could have been, but I thought it was funny.
Have a great weekend here in town, and I guess everybody at the poker rooms, the two here in town, should look out for you. Because
yeah, I'm coming to town. Be careful.
Thanks, Gabe. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks, Paul.
Gabe Kaplan, welcome back to St. Louis this weekend. This is the Big 550 KTRS.